welcome to Giving an Answer, the show dedicated to defending the historic Christian faith. I am your host, A.C. Felder. Today the topic is the Second Coming of Christ. And to discuss this topic, I have a special guest, and my special guest is Tom Baker. Let me tell you about Tom. Tom has a master's in philosophy from Southern Evangelical Seminary with a concentration in biblical languages. That's how I actually know him. We were classmates. He is currently working on his PhD at Southern Evangelical Seminary in philosophy of religion, and he has taught various classes on various apologetic topics. And is there something I'm missing?
The master's is in apologetics, not philosophy. My wife Marianne and I have two boys, Christian and Michael. They're adults now, out of the house, so we're empty nesters. And just focusing on ministry, I teach a Sunday school class at Carmel Baptist Church called Digging Deeper on Sundays at 9:30. So if you're in town and you're at Carmel Baptist, come up to our class. We do apologetics and theology.
Okay.
It's a lot of fun.
Great. So let's get to the topic, the Second Coming of Christ. How did you get interested in this topic?
Second Coming. This topic is just fascinating. And I've taught it a couple times at the church. But one of the things I found right away was that there's just so many views out there.
Yeah.
There's different millennial theories, different tribulation rapture theories. And so as I'm teaching the class, people would start raising their hand and go, what about this view? What about this view? And so as I dug deeper and deeper into it, one of the things I wanted to do was try to give them some handrails to figure it out. But the Second Coming, I mean, this is just such an important, this is one of the essentials of the Christian faith. If Christ doesn't come back,
right?
Christ is to come back to complete our salvation,
right?
The resurrection, to defeat death, to defeat Satan, to usher in righteousness.
Right.
So, I mean, it's just... Topic's
yeah,
awesome.
It's sort of like the story isn't finished unless he comes back.
That's right. If he doesn't come back, the story's not finished. So yeah, this is a huge topic, and I just love it. It's just a fascinating, and it's edifying.
So what do we mean when we say the Second Coming of Christ? For those who aren't believers, they may be flipping through the channels. Second? What do you mean second?
Right.
What is that?
Right, the Second Coming.
Right.
So we call it the Second Coming because Christ came back the first time. He already came back, walked the earth, died on the cross, and rose from the dead. Believers hold these doctrinal views. Well, there's a doctrine, which is an essential of the faith, that he's going to come back again a second time. He's going to defeat the enemy. He's going to defeat death. He's going to defeat Satan. And so the Bible's filled with all these prophecies about the second coming of Christ, that he's going to come back and then usher in righteousness. And so the study of the Second Coming is looking at the biblical data, the Bible, and see what it has to say, and looking at all the prophecies, and it's just awesome.
For someone who doesn't understand where the Second Coming fits into the whole end time scenario, give us a basic or general overview of the end time so that we can get a grasp of exactly where this fits into the picture.
Right, yeah, and there's a couple major views on this, but... I'll try to kind of surface a pre-mill, pre-trib view. And yes, we'll explain what those are a little bit later. But so we have the first coming that Christ came. And then we have, after he died on the cross and rose from the dead, we have this kind of church age.
That's the age we're in now, correct?
Yeah, that's the age we're in now, the church age. And the Bible is not explicit on how long that takes place. In fact, Jesus in the gospel says no one knows the day or the hour of his second coming. So we're in this church age. Well, sometime in the future, Christ is going to come back. And there's different viewpoints on whether the world's going to get worse or the world's going to get better. And so there's a couple different views on that. But through this church age, at some point in the future, Christ is going to come back.
Okay. So now, he's coming back, but how does that fit into all the other things like... hell and the millennium and the new heaven and a new earth.
right. Yeah, and this is where we start getting into a whole handful of views. there's basically three millennial views.
Okay.
And they go by, and millennium means 1,000 years.
Okay.
And so there's pre-mill, which is Christ coming before the 1,000 years.
What's this 1,000 years about?
Yeah, this 1,000 years, exactly. This 1,000 year is prophesied in the Bible about a time of blessing, 1,000 years of blessing, a time of peace, where Christ is reigning directly on the earth.
Okay.
And so this 1,000 years of blessing, some people take it as a literal 1,000 years, and some people don't. And some people take the second coming and put it before the 1,000 years, put it afterwards. And then, of course, there's some people that say, there's no 1,000 years, and they hold an amill view, A meaning they negate the millennial view, and they say, well, Christ, we're sort of in the millennium right now, and Christ is reigning right now through the church. So this is where we get these three views. We get the pre-mill view, Christ coming before the 1,000 years. We get the amill view, meaning there is no millennium, Christ is reigning through the church right now. And then we get this post-mill view, where Christ is coming back at the after the 1,000 years.
Okay.
And so there's, and so this is where, when I've taught the second coming at church, people immediately go, wow, okay, this looks complicated. Within Christianity, we have Christians who hold all these different views. How do I even decipher which one's right or wrong? So so it's interesting. And trying to come up with some principles on how to adjudicate the different views is important.
Why is this issue even important? Why should we even care which view is correct, or why should we even care if he's coming back for a second time?
Yeah. You know, and this is one of the things about doctrine. I think it's super important to be theologically precise, to be true. We have the Bible, we have all this biblical data, and we know that all of them can't be true at the same time. One of them's true. And so I think the point comes to being lovers of the truth and making sense of it. I want to know the truth. Right. People want to know the truth. And I don't think anyone wants to hold a view randomly or whimsically, or they want to know what they believe is right. Not knowing just what they believe, but why they believe it and know it's true.
Right.
And if Christ is coming back, we should be aware of what the doctrine is. So I think it's just highly important.
Okay. Now, what does all this fit in with the tribulation? Is that dependent on the view that you hold as far as pre-mill or amill?
Right, yeah, and this is where things even get more a step more complicated, and this is where I like to try to help people, because, I mean, you can get on the internet, and if you Google or look up, you know, the second coming, you're going to get a whole variety of views, and some people get a little intimidated. How do I even get started? So with the three millennial views, there's a number of tribulation and rapture theories. Now, tribulation is this time of trial upon the earth, a time of wickedness when wickedness runs rampant. It's a time of outpouring of God's wrath. Now, this is where we also have to kind of ask, you know, some people have different views on the tribulation. What is the true nature of the tribulation? And there's also this concept of the rapture.
Right.
And in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, it has this concept that Christ is going to come back and we're going to be caught up together with him in the air. And then other passages talk about Christ coming back to the earth. And so people see these two different events. Many people see these two different, the Christ coming back to the earth or meeting him in the air, as two separate events.
Right.
Some people don't see it as two separate events. Some people see it as one event, that we're going to be caught up together with the Lord in the air and then come right back down to the earth. And so these tribulation and rapture theories, and there's actually, I believe there's six, and it's, there's quite a few. There's a pre-tribulation, mid-trib, where Christ is going to rapture the church in the middle of the tribulation. There's a post-trib view, where Christ is going to rapture the church at the end of the tribulation. And then, of course, there's these other views where there's a partial rapture, where only those who are ready and looking and waiting will be raptured. The other ones will be left to go through this difficult time of the tribulation. And then lastly, there's this view called preterism, which believes that the tribulation has already happened in AD 70 in the destruction of Jerusalem. And there's actually two views in that. There's this partial preterism and full preterism. Full preterism is this view that everything has happened. The tribulation, the second coming, the resurrection, it's all happened. And full preterism in terms of Orthodox Christianity is heretical because it's an Orthodox doctrine. It's one of the essentials of the faith that Christ is going to come back in the future.
Right.
And there's going to be resurrection. Partial preterism is only the tribulation part has happened in AD 70. Now we're just waiting for Christ to come back.
Okay.
So, I mean, obviously you look at all these views and you go, well, okay, that, now I'm overwhelmed. How do I even get started in deciphering this stuff? So that's part of what I like to do is try to give people some principles for that.
So let's do that. Let's use your principles. Let's evaluate these views, the positive, negatives, or whatever, and see where it leads us.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's basically seven, and I'll list them out, and then I'll unpack each one. The first one I think is probably the most important. That is the method we use to interpret the Bible. We often refer to this historical, grammatical, literal method. So that's the first one, and I'll unpack what that is in a little bit. The biblical covenants. Biblical covenants have an important role in the end time program, the biblical covenants and how they apply to Israel and the church. Some people see Israel and the church as one thing now.
Right.
The other one is the nature of the millennium. We talked a little bit about it, given a definition of the millennium, but what is the real nature of the millennium? Is this really a literal 1,000 years? Is this really a time of blessing? So what is the true nature of the millennium? This is what I like to call a gating factor. And then the nature of the rapture.
When you say gating, what do you mean?
By gating factor, I mean these seven items that I'm going to list. These are gating in the sense of depending on how you, what position you hold on these views, mm-hmm. it sort of leads you down one road or another.
Okay, as it guides.
Yeah, like a gate. You go down, you take a position on that, it's going to lead you down one road. So with the biblical covenants, and their application to Israel and the church, if you see their application to Israel and church as one thing, or if you see them separate, well, that's going to be a gating factor. That's going to lead you down one sort of road to defining the whole end time program. So we have the literal historical method. We have the biblical covenants and their application to the church in Israel. We have the nature of the millennium. What is the true nature of the millennium? We have the nature of the rapture. What is the rapture? And why do we have it?
Right.
The nature of the tribulation. Is this really an outpouring of God's wrath? Is the church going to go through this time of the tribulation?
Right.
Or are we in the tribulation right now? So the nature of the tribulation. And then this concept of the imminence of Christ. Some groups hold that Christ could come back at any moment, that there's nothing that has to be fulfilled before Christ comes back. In other words, you don't have to wait for, you know, three events to happen before Christ comes back. The imminence of Christ says that Christ can come back at any moment. Right. And then the last one is the author and dating of the book of Revelation. What date do we give to this book? Who wrote it?
Right.
And there's one particular view, the preterist view, the partial preterist view, is and the full preterist as well, is almost entirely set on an early dating of the book of Revelation.
Okay.
So these seven views, what I call gating factors, are important things that depending on how you, what you take on these particular views, how you define them, is going to lead you down one of these views.
Right. Okay. Okay. So let's use those to evaluate some of these views.
Yeah. The first one, the historical, grammatical, literal method. One of the interesting aspects of this, and I'm going to pull up a slide here, is interpreting the Bible literally. You know, we sometimes talk about fundamentals. Although those guys just interpret the Bible literally, but it is the normal approach in all languages. The fact that I'm speaking to you, you have to interpret me literally.
Right.
In fact, even the non-literal depends on the literal. And this is kind of interesting. Like, for example, one of the things that Jesus said is, do not cast your pearls before swine. Okay, well, that's sort of a figure of speech. He didn't really mean to do it. But the only way to really understand what he meant by that is you have to understand what real pearls are and what swine are. So even the non-literal depends on the literal. We wouldn't even be able to make sense of the figure of speech being used there unless we understood it literally. And what's kind of ironic about this too is that even those who deny the literal method want their denial to be interpreted literally. One of the things that I try to stress is that when we're interpreting the Bible and we're reading through it and we get into prophecies, we can't read literal and switch to non-literal or figurative whimsically. We can't just do it without a reason. We can't just start reading through the text literally and then go, oh, I'm going to take this figuratively. You have to have a reason for it. We shouldn't do it whimsically. And I think what happens is a lot of folks, whether they heard a pastor speak on this or whether they were told to take this figuratively, they really don't know why. And there's a common phrase that says, if the literal sense makes good sense, seek no other sense lest it results in nonsense.
Right.
Because if we're reading the Bible literally and then we switch to figuratively and we do it whimsically without a good reason, well, we're being inconsistent.
So you're saying that we can do it, we can do some symbolic interpretation, we just need a good reason for it.
Right, and in fact, the Bible's filled with symbols and figures of speech, and it says that God is a rock, he's a strong tower. Well, he's not literally a rock, and he's not literally a strong tower.
Right.
But, and the context should be our guide as we're reading along. And so I just stress, just don't do it whimsically, have a reason. Don't just start reading literal, and switch to non-literal. And so when we approach prophecies that way, it really kind of opens up the Bible to help us to understand these things. When it says the millennium is 1,000 years, why should we take that symbolically? These are the questions we have to ask ourselves when we get into this stuff.
Right. Okay.
So that's the first one, and it's important that we have a consistent interpretation, because some of these other views rely on the fact that a lot of the items, concepts presented in the book of Revelation or the book of Daniel or some of these things, it's just figures of speech. It's all symbolism. The millennium, the 1,000 years, it's not a true 1,000 years, they would say. Well, others would say, no, it's a true 1,000 years. Yeah. So now we're stuck, right? Now we have to say, well, how do I decipher this? So that's why this is what I call a gating factor. It's important to have a consistent method.
Right.
So then the other one here is the biblical covenants and the application to Israel and the church. And as I alluded to before, some people believe that the church has replaced Israel, that Israel and the church are one thing. They don't see them as two separate entities being dealt with in the biblical text.
Right.
They don't see that these things are just for Israel and not the church. They'll say, well, now that the church is here, Jesus died on the cross and rose from the dead, now that we have the church, that the church has replaced Israel. All the things that applied to Israel now apply to the church.
Right, right.
Okay. Where others take them separately. So we have to ask ourselves, well, which way is it? Do the biblical covenants, biblical covenants apply to both of them? Is Israel and church the same entity? Or are they two separate entities? And so this is another gating factor, is to take a have a position on this.
Okay, makes sense.
And then the nature of the millennium. Is this really a time of blessing? Is this a real 1,000 years, a literal 1,000 years? So we have to take a position on that. And depending on what position you take, if you don't believe in 1,000 years, and you go, well, it's just a long time, well, that sort of sets you up for the amill view. Right.
Yeah.
If you hold 1,000, in fact, or maybe the post-mill view, which we can get into later. So already, as soon as you start responding to each one of these, you're already kind of like setting yourself up for a view. And so these are like core principles on trying to unravel this complicated doctrine.
Right. OK.
The nature of the rapture. Are we going to be caught up together with the Lord in the air? Is there a kind of a secret rapture where Christ comes back for the church, takes the church out of the earth, and then lets the rest of the people go through this tribulation, and then comes back with the church in the second coming? What's kind of interesting is there's already been two raptures, Enoch and Elijah.
Yeah,
in one sense,
true.
So we have in the Old Testament, we have Enoch being taken off the earth. We have Elijah being taken off the earth. So this concept of being raptured and being caught up into heaven, it's not a new doctrine.
Right. Yeah.
It's just whether it's for the church and the timing of it and the nature of it. That's the thing for this whole doctrine, is that everyone agrees that Christ is going to come back. Everyone agrees there's going to be a resurrection. And when I mean everyone, I mean believers who hold to Orthodox doctrine. Whether you're a Presbyterian or whether you're a Baptist or whether you're a Methodist or whatever your denomination is or non-denominational, if in Orthodox Christianity, everyone agrees that Christ is going to come back.
Yeah.
And there's going to be resurrection. They just differ on the timing and the nature of it all.
Right.
And then, of course, the nature of the tribulation. Is this really an outpouring of God's wrath? Is the church going to go through this? So that's another important part of it. And then the imminence of Christ, whether Christ could come back at any moment. Is there anything that has to be fulfilled before Christ could come back? And then the last one is the dating of the book of Revelation. There's really two dates given that most people hold, is the 95 AD date, which is obviously after the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. And then this really early date, the 65 AD date, which is prior to AD 70, the destruction of Jerusalem. So depending on what view you hold on this, if for example, the preterists believe the tribulation already happened, and so they would hold to an early date of the book of Revelation. What would happen to their view if the dating of the book of Revelation was late?
And I think I guess what you're saying is they hold to an early dating of the book of Revelation, because what they're saying is that if Revelation is written before 70 AD, before the destruction of the temple, that the Revelation is not talking about Christ coming thousands of years in the future. It's talking about the destruction of the temple, which is going to happen in only a few years. That's
absolutely
what it's referring to. And if it's written after the destruction of the temple in 90 AD, then it must be referring to something that's yet to come, because it can't be looking back on the destruction of the temple.
Absolutely. In fact, and that's it. If they want to hold that the book of Revelation is an inspired book in the canon of Scripture, and if they deny that, then of course they're going to have bigger problems.
Right.
So did the Apostle John write this book? Is it an inspired book? Well, then, if he wrote this book in 95 AD, then like you said, those events are still future.
Right.
Then they can't say, oh, well, that's already happened. That applies to AD 70. So the position you take on the dating of the book Revelation is also a gating factor, in the sense of that's going to set you up for one view or another.
Right. And I see what you're saying, because if, depending on how you look at these things, and for instance, like if you didn't take a literal view and you took a symbolic view, well, it can mean anything. Everything is up for grabs, because if you're not, if it's not a literal 1,000 years, then you're right. We could be here in the millennium age right now.
Right. Yeah. And not only that, things get a little worse. If we don't approach the Bible with this historical, grammatical, literal method. Now, yeah, granted, we said that there's figures of speech and there's symbolism in the text, but we need to approach it first in this kind of, first, we need to dig into it in a literal fashion, and then if the context suggests otherwise and we have a reason, then do so. But if we just approach the Bible as an allegory or symbolism, just right off the bat, the whole thing is just symbolism, well, then the doctrine of salvation is dependent upon that.
Yeah.
Our whole belief system, that when we read the Bible and it says that for by grace you've been saved through faith, and when Jesus said for God so loved the world that whoever believes in him shall not perish but have everlasting life, if we take these core doctrines of the gospel and we just take them as figures of speech, well then we've lost our foundation.
Yeah. Now, what I want to do is I want to go through the strengths and weaknesses of the different views. But before I do that, I just want to make it clear that these are all, except for the one version of the preterist view, these are all within the pale of orthodoxy. And what I'm saying is that if you are a Christian and you've been taught the amill view, or if you've been taught the mid-tribulation, those are all legitimate within Christianity. Those aren't heretical. They're just different views that Christians look at it. But we're not looking at you and saying that you're not a Christian if you don't believe this view. Just different views that Christians look at it. But we're going to, you know, look at the views and see what, from our perspective, which one makes sense, or from your perspective, which one. I think we hold to the same one because we were talking about both talking about Dr. Geisler, and you know, and,
right.
And I haven't found a good reason to reject his views on that yet. So
right.
We could go through and look at the strengths and weaknesses of these now.
Right, right. And one thing I want to mention too on this is that these seven gating factors, these principles, and there may be more. This is not a completed list. These are sort of brought out because, you know, you start reading books on the end times, and there's so many different views out there, and authors are writing, and I kept seeing certain things surface that they would hold that the Israel and the church are one entity and not
right.
separate. Certain things kept surfacing on all this literature by different authors that it sort of boils down to this set here.
Okay.
So where do we start? There's these nine views, three millennial theories and six tribulation and rapture theories that are the most prominent. How do we jump into this? And some people may disagree with this, but I like to start with the millennial theories first.
Okay.
Because I think it sort of shapes the whole end time program. I mean, before we can get into the second coming and some of the finer grained details of the rapture and the tribulation, you know, kind of a 100-foot 500-foot level, if you will, what's the actual program look like? What are the different ones? How do we jump into that? And so I typically start with the millennial theory. Some people start right with the tribulation theories, but if you're willing, we should do the millennial theories.
Right.
So the millennial theories are three: pre-mill, a-mill, and post-mill. That's pre-mill, a-mill, and post-mill. Pre-mill is that Christ is coming back for the millennium. A-mill is that there's really no millennium. A means it's negating it. And then post-mill, Christ coming at the end. And so I like to take the pre-mill first.
Okay.
So then we can compare the other ones. So pre-mill has, this is the view I hold. I'm telling my bias up front. I'm a pre-mill holder. And people don't have to agree with me, but I like them to understand my reasons for it and the principles. And with these seven gating factors that we mentioned, I think the pre-mill view best responds to these. It syncs up the best with these different questions that are being answered in the text here. So pre-mill. Well, it depends on the historical, grammatical, literal method. And I believe that as you read the book of Revelation, when it presents this concept of the millennium, that there's nothing in the context of the scriptures there that suggests that the 1,000 years is symbolic. I mean, you're reading through that. Where do we get this kind of symbolic nature or this figure of speech that's not really a 1,000-year reign.
Right.
And just the natural progression through the book of Revelation shows Christ in Revelation chapter 19 coming before the millennium.
Right.
You would have to reposition the chapters. The natural flow through the book of Revelation suggests that Christ comes back in Revelation 19 prior to this 1,000 years.
Right.
So you would have to flip it. And then the biblical covenants, this concept of this blessing. And it sort of, I think, for me, comes into this concept of the day of the Lord. The day of the Lord. In fact, that might even be an eighth one on our list. That all throughout the Old Testament, you come across this concept of the day of the Lord. And there's a narrow view and a wide view. Sometimes you see the day of the Lord being this time where Christ comes back and defeats his enemies in context. Then in Joel, you see both. You see this time, this time of this dark time where Christ comes back and judges the earth. And then you see also this time of blessing being referred to as part of the day as well. So the narrow view is this second coming, the day of the Lord. The wide view of the day of the Lord is this kind of dark time, and then a daytime, kind of a light, a time of light. And we have that now when we talk about day, it's not much different. You know, we say, well, 3 days from now, right. Or I'm going to mow the lawn during the day. Well, when I say mow the lawn during the day, I'm talking about the light portion of the day.
Right.
And so I think the concept of the day of the Lord has the same type of concept. So the day of the Lord, the biblical covenants and application to Israel and the church. I see Israel and the church as two distinct entities. We have the Abrahamic and the Davidic covenants being applied directly to Israel.
Okay.
And if the church has replaced Israel and the covenants are for the church, well, then we should see either fulfillment now or future fulfillment for the church. One of the covenants is that Israel is going to be dwelling in the land in peace. And right now, Israel's not dwelling. And it's not just for a short period of time, it's forever.
Right.
So when in the history have we ever seen Israel dwelling in the land in peace.
Right.
Forever?
Right.
The other thing is we see King David being referenced in the scriptures and Christ on the earth reigning over Israel. And so when have we seen this?
We haven't.
In fact, this challenges the post-mill view, because if Christ doesn't come back before the millennium, then how is he going to be on the earth reigning? So the post-mill almost has a chronological problem. If you bring Christ back at the end of the millennium, well, then he's not on earth reigning, as it says. In fact, in Zechariah 14:4, it says he will put his foot on the Mount of Olives.
Right.
During the day of the Lord. And the whole passage is on the day of the Lord. He's going to come back and put his foot on the Mount of Olives. Well, if he doesn't come back until the end of the millennium, then this whole millennium with him reigning and being on the earth is sort of has a chronological problem.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense.
So as I go through the nature of the millennium, the nature of the rapture, the nature of the tribulation, and all these different gating factors, for me, the pre-mill view, I think, best answers, provides the best evidence for these.
Okay.
So, and then, of course, the A-mill and the post-mill, which we touched on before, I think the A-mill view, you have to take Scripture symbolically in certain cases. For example, the millennium. You can't take it as a literal 1,000 years. You have to take it as a long time. And every place you see this millennium being talked about in the later part of the book of Ezekiel and Revelation, you see it as a time of blessing, a time of ushered peace, a time of Israel dwelling in its land in peace, with Christ reigning, Isaiah chapter 9. When have we seen that?
Yeah.
So how can we be in the millennium now? If the A-mill view presents the issue that we're in the millennium right now and Christ is reigning through the church, then where is the fulfillment of these covenants? Where is the fulfillment that Israel is dwelling in the land of peace?
Right.
Where is this time of righteousness? So how can we be said to be in the millennium? So I think they have to come back with some answers to those kind of questions.
Well, and I think the thing that sort of I find most difficult about that view is that Scripture teaches that Satan is bound during that 1,000 years, which would mean that he's bound now.
Right.
But I look around, clearly he's not bound. But not only that, we see in Scripture where the Scripture tells us, you know, that he is as a roaring lion seeking who he made a vow. Well, he has to be around if he's seeking who he made a vow, or resist the devil and he will flee from you. That means he must be around if I can resist him. So clearly he's not bound. He's alive and well.
Right. And I suppose they could have some wiggle room there and go, well, the kind of wickedness we see on the earth, that's man. That's man wickedness. But then again, we see in Psalm chapter 2 that when Christ reigns, he's going to reign with a rod of iron.
Right.
He's going to be the judge.
Right.
The government's going to be upon his shoulders. He's going to be reigning, and Israel's going to be dwelling in peace. Well, we don't see that. So I think the A-mill view has some challenges to overcome those things. And then post-mill, what's kind of interesting about the post-mill is they hold that because of evangelism and the sharing of the gospel and the work of the church, that the world's going to start getting better, that they have this kind of positive outlook, unlike a pre-mill view, where the world's going to get better through the sharing of the gospel, to the point where they're going to usher in the millennium.
Right.
They're going to bring the evangelism is going to bring in this millennium, and then Christ is going to come back at the end. Well, what's interesting is you have some concepts in Isaiah chapter 11 and Isaiah 65 and 66 that during this time of millennium, there's also going to be some changes on the earth, and lifespans are going to change. People are going to live longer. There's going to be peace and blessing. And if you look at the natural progression of even in the book of Revelation, you have the resurrection happening prior to that. You have the second coming happening. You have resurrection happening before the millennium, and you have the second coming happening before the millennium. So this idea of the post-mill ushering in righteousness through sharing the gospel, where does the resurrection fit into that? Right. Where do these changes that are talked about in Scripture going to happen? Where does the second coming happen into that whole thing? They put it at the very end, and so I think they have a chronological problem, because it also says that Christ is going to be reigning on the earth over Israel.
Right.
So he would have to come back before the millennium, not afterwards. So these three views, and yeah, I sort of presented my bias on the pre-mill.
Well, but what would be their issues with the pre-mill view? What would they say are weaknesses for the pre-mill view, in all fairness?
I know some people that are a-mill, and I know some people that are post-mill, and, you know, they're godly Christians and stuff. But see, this is the part of the gating factors. Let's get into the kind of raw materials, these principles. What position do you hold? And one of those is that we make a distinction between Israel and the church, a pre-mill view.
Right.
And they would see them as the same thing. So if you see Israel and the church as the same thing, that church is sort of this kind of replacement theology where the church has replaced Israel.
Right.
Well, then there's no need to apply these biblical covenants to Israel. The church is fulfilling those things now.
I got you. Right.
Through Christ. And so that becomes a gating factor. And so they say, well, you're not understanding the proper application of the biblical covenants. You're not understanding the role of the church in relationship to Israel.
Right.
So that's where we would have our study, is to dig into that together.
Okay, I got you.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, I think once we lay out that kind of foundation on the millennium and what is the true nature of the millennium, you have to look at Isaiah 11, you have to look at Isaiah 65 and 66, and then once we get kind of this 100-foot level of where the millennium is and where the second coming happens, then we deal with tribulation.
Okay.
And rapture.
Let's deal with tribulation.
So tribulation. So this outpouring of God's wrath. Several times in Scripture, it says that and if you look at the progression in the book of Revelation, you see it's a time of God's wrath. Well, where people differ is where does God's wrath start and man's wrath ends, or Satan's wrath? And so this time of tribulation, is it truly a outpouring of God's wrath? Is all the tribulation from when it's first presented in Scripture, this great tribulation that's going to come upon the earth? Where does God's wrath start? And so depending on how you take the tribulation, you have several views that kind of come out of that. You have this pre-trib, which holds that this entire time of tribulation that's presented in Scripture, in Matthew chapter 24 and Revelation, is an outpouring of God's wrath, and the church is saved from that. They would say, a pre-trib person would say, that the church is saved from God's wrath, because Christ took the wrath of God for us
right.
on the cross.
Right.
And so the church is not to be a recipient of God's wrath. And so they would say that the church is going to be raptured out of the earth. And so this idea of the rapture and the tribulation are kind of intertwined. How you view the tribulation kind of, you also have to deal with the rapture. And so a pre-trib position would hold to the rapture happening before this tribulation. They would say the tribulation is 7 years. And see, that's debatable too. Other views may not hold to a strict 7 years. Others would say that, there's 7 years of tribulation, but the first half is not an outpouring of God's wrath. That the church is actually going to go through the first 3.5 years of the tribulation and then be raptured. And then there's another view called the pre-wrath view. And Dr. Thomas Ice likes to call it the three-quarters rapture view, where the church is going to go through kind of pretty much three-quarters of the way through the seven-year period and then be raptured. And their view is such that they've looked through the book of Revelation and Scripture, and they don't see God's wrath being mentioned or presented until the last one-quarter, if you will, of the tribulation period. So they would hold to this pre-wrath view or three-quarters rapture.
Okay.
And then there's the post-trib, where some people say, hey, we got tribulation now, and we're going to have tribulation in the future, and the church is being persecuted right now on the earth, and people are being martyred in other countries for their faith. This tribulation is no different. They would say it's a tougher time, but the church is going to go through the whole thing.
Okay.
And then Christ is going to come back at the end. And the rapture in that post-trib view would be that. Yeah, you're going to be raptured up with Christ, but you're going to come right back down to the earth again.
Okay.
Whereas with the pre-trib view, you're going to be raptured, but you're not going to come back until 7 years later. There's a tribulation that's in the middle between the rapture and when you come back.
Okay.
So the timing is different. Pre-trib, there's a separation of 7 years between the rapture and when you come back with Christ in Revelation 19. Mid-trib, you got 3.5. And then pre-wrath, you have 1/4. And then post-trib, it all happens at the end.
Okay.
So, you know, we hear these views and we can read about them, we can buy books on them. But how do we discern between these? And yeah, we can read scripture and you can have educated Bible students and theologians going, arguing for one particular view.
Yeah.
Scholarly
people take... You know, right. All of these positions. I mean, there are scholarly people who adhere to each one of these positions.
Right.
So it's not like, you know, the scholars pick one and the others pick... No, this is something that people look at who are very, very intelligent and come down to different conclusions.
Yeah, it can be frustrating at times, too, because people can get very passionate.
Yeah,
you know, my bias again is as soon as we mention SES or Dr. Norm Geisler, it sort of lets the cat out of the bag, if you will.
Right.
My bias is I'm pre-mill and pre-trib.
Right.
But I'm not going to die on the pre-trib hill.
Right.
You know what I mean? I mean, there's some things in essentials unity, and non-essentials liberty, and all things charity.
Right.
You know, I'm strongly pre-mill and I'm strongly pre-trib. I've been studying this for years. That's the position I hold. But I'm not going to die on a pre-trib hill.
Right.
I mean, there's more important things, and some things are difficult to figure out.
I remember Dr. Geisler was saying, when I actually took the class End Times from him at Southern, I remember him saying that if he's around at the time and he realizes that the tribulation has started, then he's going to be like, okay, I guess I'm not a pre-mill anymore. And then if he gets into the 3.5 years and he's still here, well, I guess I'm not a mid-trib either. And then these things. So he's like, well, I'm not, you know, like you say, I'm not down on any of those hills. It's like, well, I can be wrong. And I'm flexible enough to admit that I can be wrong.
Right, yeah. And, you know, this we have to be careful, too, in that we have some essentials that we all agree on.
Right.
And we don't want to major in the minors.
Right.
Or minor in the majors either. So we want to try to do due diligence on this topic. So I think it really comes down when we look at these, when we lay out these tribulation theories, and of course there's the preterist view or the partial preterist view, when we lay out these theories, this is where these other gating factors come into play. And that is really getting into what is the nature of the tribulation. And we need to dig into Scripture. We need to unravel that and the nature of the rapture. So that's part of the process that we have to go through, is to march through all these tribulation rapture theories using those gating factors as sort of like our handrails,
right,
to maneuver through that.
Okay. All right, so any concluding remarks, or is there anything else you wanted to add?
Well, no, I mean, there's a lot more we can do with the millennium, and maybe we can do that in another episode. And there's definitely stuff we have some work to do on the tribulation rapture to unravel this. But again, my approach is to use the gating factors and then go, okay, so biblical covenants. Let's go and look at the Abrahamic covenant and read it.
Right.
And when we read the actual Abrahamic covenant, if we use the historical, grammatical, literal method, and it says to Israel, and it promises a land forever, and we read the Davidic covenant, and it promises a king forever, when we read those things, do we take those things literally, or do we take them figuratively? Because if we take them literally, then when is that going to be fulfilled? So marching through these things and then pulling back out again and asking our question of, okay, so on a millennial theory, what does this say about a pre-mill, a-mill, post-mill? What is, now that I've dug into Scripture, always coming back to the biblical text, well, what does this say about the nature of the tribulation? Is it truly an outpouring of God's wrath? The whole thing, all 7 years, if there's a 7-year tribulation period in the future, is all 7 years an outpouring of God's wrath? Where does it say in the biblical text? What is the true nature of the tribulation? And for that, we have to dig into Scripture.
Right. Sounds good. You've done a good job of explaining it. But I do have a question. So what would you say to someone who says, well, when you look at Revelations, clearly, I mean, a lot of that stuff we just cannot take literally. I mean, it talks about the bowls of wrath being poured out on the people. It talks about these creatures flying around and stinging people, and the sky, the stars falling from the sky. So clearly these are symbolic, so we can't read those symbolically, can we?
Yeah, you know, there's an important principle here too that I should have mentioned before. Even when Scripture has symbolisms, metaphors and figures of speech, they do pertain to some reality. We can't just say it doesn't mean anything. So when it presents, let's say, God is a rock or he's a strong tower. Well, that figure of speech does represent some reality. It's not meaningless.
Right.
It means something. And so I think when we approach the book of Revelation, we do see some figures of speech there. And we have to say, well, what does this figure of speech represent? It does pertain to some reality. It does mean something. We can't just say it means nothing. And so I think that's an important principle to keep in mind.
I agree. Well, I want to thank you, Tom Baker, for being on the show, talking with me about the second coming of Christ. And that will end this episode. And until then, goodbye and God bless.
You can find out more about Giving an Answer, as well as listen to other episodes, by visiting us online at www.givinganswer.org.